we're about to start. Okay. All right. Well, thank you all for coming. My name is Nikos Pelasgos, and I'll just speak real quickly about myself. I've been kind of just trying to figure out what's going on with our world for about 3 or 4 years now. Since Occupy Wall Street, that's kind of what got me going, and I've just kept going and going. So that's my story.
Hi, my name is Kyle Lee. I studied environmental engineering at Cal Poly, and basically, all my faith was in technology saving us from environmental disaster, but learning more about it, I've gotten a lot more pessimistic about it and looking for alternative approaches to avoiding environmental collapse. So basically, this is where I am today as a result of that.
Hi, I'm Charlie Mountain. I also studied environmental engineering. Kind of have a similar story. I used to be a little more, have a little more faith in technology than I do now. And I've just been, you know, learning more, and this presentation is definitely a good learning experience for me. And I wish I could have checked out other presentations this week, but I'm glad y'all came to ours.
All right. So I'll start us off here. So, Before we really get too far into this, I want to go ahead and acknowledge that we're standing on occupied Chumash land. That, I know that this is becoming something more common in sort of academic-y, activist-y places, and that's a good thing. It's particularly relevant to what we're going to be talking about today. The UCSB actually stands on one of a thriving Chumash village. And it's along the same lines. I'm non-native. I'm a settler. All three of us are. And so we're speaking, from that perspective. And we're doing the best we can from that perspective. So the origin of kind of like the general things that we're going to be talking about is not our ideas. As we've been sharing, we're very, very new to them. And they're not even necessarily white academic people's ideas. These are things that indigenous people have been sharing for a long time, ever since civilization really started intruding on their lands, and more recently in academic settings by native scholars. So here's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. You know, we're going to be really looking at civilization. Oops, I kind of jumped ahead there. Basically, you can, figure out where we're going here. I want to say real quick that when we say civilization, we're not talking about culture. There's a conflation in our society with civilization meaning art and language and all the things that we associate with culture. So there's a distinction here, and we're going to go into that right here. When I'm talking about civilization, this is one of my favorite definitions. An unnatural catastrophe created when a human culture practices full-time agriculture, causing their population to spiral into a positive feedback loop of growth, social hierarchy, soil depletion, and genocidal expansion that leads to an eventual collapse of ecosystems, biological diversity, and culture. And colonization and imperialism. So basically, this civilization here that we see has been going on for a very long time, since the beginning of the agricultural revolution. And this is basically the outgrowth of that. And then you add in fossil fuels and it just went nuts. Importantly, civilization is obviously not the only way that we know how to live. There have been indigenous cultures, and in fact, as humans, we've been living as modern humans, anatomically modern humans, for at least 200,000 years. And hominids, 2.5 million years. So for the vast majority of those 200,000 years, we are living in sustainable, thriving cultures. Very different ones all across the world. The agricultural revolution happened in a few different places about 6 to 10,000 years ago. So it's really very recent. It's an experiment that has overtaken a lot. So I do want to say that when we're talking about agriculture, we're not talking about horticulture. And let's make a really quick distinction here that agriculture that we're talking about is when you clear a forest or a prairie and you plant just human food, usually cereal grains, and that depletes the soil. That's where the soil depletion happens. Now, there are plenty of indigenous cultures who have used horticulture to actually make the land, you know, land management practices so that they could, they actually help make more food to eat on the land, but in a way that was sustainable and in a way that actually was diverse and caused the forests and et cetera to flourish. So basically what I'm saying is that it's not like you can't touch nature. They actually, there's a book called Tending the Wild. And, you know, indigenous cultures, not just here, the native cultures here, but all across the world have been doing this. In fact, some people say the Amazon rainforest, you know, is largely a result of the indigenous people there using certain soil enriching practices. So, why is civilization inherently unsustainable? So basically what happens, as we were just seeing in that definition, is the land is being degraded. At the same time, the population is exploding. So, by definition, it's unsustainable. At a certain point, you have a population where you are requiring the importation of resources, where you necessarily have to go take them from other people. And agriculture, there's a part of our myth is that this was progress, right? Part of our whole civilization myth is that this was progress. And that's really what we're going to talk about today. We're going to get into really questioning that. But the question is, how did agriculture spread if it wasn't done so, like, voluntarily? Well, what happens is the population explodes. So even though those people end up, as we will see, actually not as healthy or happy, and actually agriculture requires backbreaking work compared to hunter-gatherer horticulturalist societies, the reason that this happened is because agricultural societies had the numbers. They had that explosion of population, and therefore they needed to take it. They had the numbers, and they were able to take it. So, moving on here. This is basically, you know, self-explanatory and kind of what I'm talking about. Okay, here we have sort of civilization's hierarchical structure. I think it's just basically it's important to note that all these social justice struggles that we're talking about, all the oppression, it's, you know, all those talks you've been listening to all week, it all comes down to inequality, oppression, and there's this kind of like maybe this idea that this is just part of humanity, and it's not. And if we really want to get to the root of what all these problems are, it started here in civilization. It started when man started putting themselves on top of women, children, animals, plants, rocks, indigenous peoples. So I really just want us all to think about that. Like, if you're really thinking about the root problem, what is the root problem? Is it capitalism? Is it colonialism? Is it, you know, what causes imperialism? And it's this, it's civilization. So, I think I'm going to run out of time in a second here for my little section. But this is the Fertile Crescent. So the Fertile Crescent is one of the areas that agriculture started. And it's called the Fertile Crescent because back in the day it was huge cedar forests. And agriculture comes in, and after many, many generations of agriculture, you end up with depleted soil, and now that area is a desert. Same thing happening here in Africa. This is deforestation and soil loss as a result of agriculture again. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about Okay, so my section is about to wrap up here, so I just want to say a couple things. Not all indigenous cultures are the same, and not all of them were perfect. Obviously, they were very diverse. They're not utopian. We're not saying that. But we are going to try and make a distinction now between the general patterns and similarities between indigenous cultures or sustainable cultures versus civilization. And as these two expand on that, I'm going to be making these T-charts, where on the left side, I'm going to have indigenous cultures in general, the patterns, on the other side, civilization. So I have it broken up here in social, spiritual, environmental, and human health. So, you know, if you want to glance at those every once in a while, I'm just going to be filling those out while we're doing this presentation. So, I think I will also just say that, you know, Native peoples still do exist all over the world. Chumash people still exist. In fact, a couple of them spoke yesterday. And to a greater or less extent, some of these indigenous cultures are still able to practice their traditional life ways. And we need to be defending that at all costs. And I'll get into that a little bit later. But I just want to say that, you know, this is an ongoing process where civilization is trying to overtake indigenous peoples and their lands, and really anybody who's trying to stop environmental destruction. So these are just some headlines that we plucked out. This last one was just from a few days ago in Flint. And, you know, devastating cost. Pass it on.
Alright. So again, my name is Kyle, and I'm going to be going into three cultures that were sustainable hunter-gatherer societies. First, we will go over the Chumash people who lived in this area before European invaders came.
Yeah.
So, And they still do. Yeah, I don't want to make it seem like they're non-existent at all. They're still thriving today. The Chumash were some of the first human inhabitants of the Channel Islands and Santa Monica Mountains, and some archaeological evidence dates even back to 15,000 years, so they've been here a long time. At the arrival of European invaders, there were approximately 20,000 of them, ranging from Malibu in the south up to San Luis Obispo in the north, and this was an area of about 7,000 square miles. They're widely considered to have been one of the most complex non-agricultural societies, and much of their culture was based and is based on the dependence of the world around them and their acknowledgement of that. Alright. So the Chumash can be considered a maritime culture with a strong relationship with the ocean. A form of canoe called the tomol was built, they're built using locally sourced driftwood from redwood trees in the north, as well as local tar. And this was used to enhance their trade among coastal villages up and down the area here, as well as fishing. And it even allowed them to thrive on the islands off the coast. Here you can see some abalone jewelry, as well as tools. These are particular fishing hooks. They also use seashells for money, and they made wide use of all kinds of resources. They used plants and animals, and when they used plants, they generally used all the plant. They didn't really let a lot of things go to waste. So their long-lasting life is attributed to their subsistent relationship with plants, animals, and fish, rather than a domination of these so-called resources. It's definitely an understanding that it's a relationship with life, not some, you know, game of occupation where you try to collect as much as you can before you die. So almost all form of the local environment was used. Even stars were used to help guide them in an ever-changing world, evident here in some cave paintings. Some of their art continues to exist today, and their beliefs, stories, ceremonies, and songs, all of which were passed down orally, generation to generation, still continue to present day. So now we'll talk about the kung. It's actually pronounced kung. It's like a clicking sound, but for presentation purposes, I'll just say kung. They inhabit the Kalahari Desert, which is in present-day Botswana, South Africa, and Namibia. And this is a very harsh environment, which definitely is reflective in their culture. They combine their philosophies of medicine, worship, and community in their practice of shamanism. And this definitely helped them thrive in their environment. So there are sand people who live in the Kalahari Desert. And their sex roles were apparent, but not oppressive. They were biologically based and centered on what was best for the community. The collective wealth of the tribe was primary. Nobody was richer than another, and even their leaders ate the same portion of food than everyone else. Women generally care for the children, gather berries, green vegetables, and water-retaining plants, as well as roots and melons. And the men hunt wild game, even the occasional giraffe, with poison-tipped arrows and spears. And humility was ingrained without fear, humility is ingrained in their hunting traditions, and arrogance is shunned. So basically, the men would go out and hunt, and if they got a kill, they wouldn't bring it back to camp. They would come back without it and be like, oh, well, yeah, I didn't get anything, and the next day they'd go out and look for it kind of thing. And it was all based on the idea that it wasn't some kind of feat of heroism to go out and kill something and eat it. It was a collective effort, and even the people who provided the arrows to the hunter was given more claim to the kill than the one who actually went out and did it. And whenever we talk about these sex roles, or I talk about these sex roles, it's not something that was set in concrete sort of thing. They traded roles throughout life, and it wasn't something that was humiliated or shunned. It was something that was just done because it needed to be done. The earth was considered primary midwife during childbirth, and laboring women would walk up to a mile away from camp to deliver the child alone. And if enough time passed without her coming back, elder women would go out and aid her, but this was a very infrequent occurrence. Usually they successfully went out and birth a child on their own, which is pretty an amazing feat in where they live. Historically, women had more power in this culture compared to similar hunter-gatherer cultures, largely due to their supply of 60 to 80% of the food supply. So basically, in hunter-gatherer cultures, it's pretty well known that gathering is more of a consistent food supply than hunting, and the harsh environment just exacerbates this. However, with the growing dependence on colonial agriculture for income, the men are having to go out and work on these farms, you know, huge industrial farms and stuff like that. They're seeing these good traits of their culture diminish as far as domestic violence is increasing, women dependence on their husband is increasing as well. As well as home confinement, which is evident and is mainly due to the fact of switching from, you know, local community-based society and hunter-gathering compared to the large, you know, ubiquitous agricultural society where everything's based on economy rather than health. So now we're going to talk about the Pygmies of Zaire, which is actually a diverse population in Africa that inhabits the Zaire Basin, which is now commonly called the Congo Basin. So they're small in stature people, which allows them to move freely throughout the forest. This trait is indicative of, you know, them living there for a very long time without other people coming in and, you know, living among them kind of thing. So they've definitely been here for a very long time, so much so that their genetics are slightly divergent than the rest of the population. So again, sex roles are apparent, but they're not oppressive. They're community-based. Men go out and hunt, and women are generally home takers, home carers. But it's not so much that it's like the male's property, like it is in our mainstream culture in America, where, you know, it'd be like the man's winning the you know, bringing home the bacon kind of thing, and then like the woman is like supposed to clean up after him and take care of the home while he's gone. In this culture, the woman is the owner of the home. If there's some kind of domestic dispute, it is common for them to actually pick apart their house as kind of like a threat to like, well, you know, if you don't do what I say, I'm gonna pick up our home and move on kind of thing. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Also, collective mothering is something that's is very unique about this culture. They don't keep their children to themselves, kind of thing. Like in their immediate family, the entire community helps raise children. And even so, even further than that, children aren't really referred to as boys or girls, and you know, all throughout adult life. People aren't referred to as, you know, gendered sort of names like he, she. Their name, their words for that are gender neutral. There is no gender in their culture. And they're also, sorry, one more quick thing. They're also very musical. They have a polyphonic music. I don't want to, you know, get into polyphonics, that's a whole other thing. But basically, they have a very ancient and unwritten culture. And, you know, so this kind of music style has been around for a very long time, and it took the Europeans up until the 14th century to develop similar music styles. And music permeates throughout their life. It ranges from entertainment purposes to ceremonial, as well as to day-to-day activities such as working. They'll have like a song for, you know, to help them go along with certain working activities. So they're, even, you know, their work while they're doing it is community-based, because, you know, if you're singing a song with someone else while you're working, it helps smooth things along and helps build that, you know, sense of equality and purpose, and knowing that, you know, someone else is doing the same exact thing as you. So now we're going to go into some specific points about these cultures and how they relate to the dominant culture.
Yeah, so like Kyle just said, like Nico said earlier, we're not saying, you know, obviously all indigenous cultures, they're not the same. We're just talking about kind of overall patterns and definitely contrasting these with the dominant culture, especially the United States, since that's where we live. So the biggest and probably most important difference between us and these cultures that we've been talking about is that they're hunter-gatherers while we're agriculturalists. I could do a whole presentation, honestly, just on agriculture, so I'm just going to briefly say, like we talked about before, agriculture is really the root of civilization. You can't have civilization without agriculture, and from that stems, you know, oppression and all these terrible things that come with it. So therefore, our culture really has no hope of being egalitarian, being based on agriculture, while sustainable indigenous cultures are largely, and were largely, a lot more egalitarian than ours is. On the economic side, hunter-gatherers, you know, they don't hoard stuff, they don't have private property, there's not really social classes, and everyone, you know, kind of shares in the work, shares in the food. So here's a quote from Richard Hooker about urbanization. So urbanization, basically the same thing as civilization. Urbanization drastically changes social relations. In place of real biological relationships based on kinship, urbanized cultures organize themselves around more abstract, less stable, and inherently unequal lines. In particular, urbanized society is organized around class, that is, economic function, rather than kinship. Economic function produces a kind of social inequality, as administrators, kings, and priests come to occupy economically more important roles than others. While there really is no such thing as social mobility in the ancient world, class is inherently unsustainable as a way of organizing society. So he's saying, you know, in the ancient world, that is before civilization, societies were, you know, much more egalitarian than they are now. He goes on to say that urbanization also produces a split in human experience. Life is divided into a public and domestic sphere. In small tribal societies, the split is non-existent or barely evident, but urbanization produces a marked distinction between these two spheres. Almost universally, men dominate the newly formed public sphere, administration, regulation, and military organizations. Social inequality then gets established along sexual lines as well as economic function. This is a dramatic and traumatic change for any society to go through. Literally, the entire worldview has to adapt dramatically to account for this new inequality. For instance, most religions probably began as goddess religions. The new urbanized societies, however, develop god religions in their place. So he brings up the hierarchy that places men over women, which I want to talk more about now. Like Kyle touched on before, you know, there were obviously sex roles which were based on biology. You know, they weren't a function of, you know, misogyny, the oppression of women in hunter-gatherer societies. The work of both men and women was seen as important. They were different, but they were both important for the community. So, you know, for example, women can't be out hunting all day if they have to breastfeed and take care of kids. It's just, you know, how it works. It's also in the community's best interest to have men doing the more dangerous work like hunting, because if you think about it, you know, women are a lot more important for reproduction, so it's kind of okay if men are out there dying. Women are the more important ones. Anthropologists have found that women are less subordinated in hunter-gatherer societies in many different respects, including men's control over their sexuality, exploiting their labor, confining them physically, using them as objects and transactions. And there have also been studies of pre-industrial societies that report little or no sexual violence at all. There are accounts of some African hunter-gatherer societies where there's absolutely no rape or sexual violence. Obviously, our culture is a lot different. Just in the U.S., one out of every six American women has been the victim of attempted or completed rape, and I've definitely heard numbers that are way higher than that. Domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women ages 15 to 44 in this country, and a woman is beaten by her male partner every 15 seconds. Meanwhile, 98% of rapists never even spend a day in jail in this country. So another point that Richard Hooker touched on was the shift from goddess religions to the male god. The oldest human art testifies to the importance of female fertility. We have the quintessential, you know, Venus statue with the exaggerated sexual features. These kinds of statues have been found near what appear to be altars and charred bones, suggesting animal sacrifice, so likely part of a religious ceremony. Conversely, the popular religions, you know, nowadays, like Christianity in this culture, there's the patriarchal god, and, you know, there's other examples around the world. I also just think it's really interesting, and that's what I was trying to show on this slide, the contrast between this very, you know, fertile, voluptuous woman in the statue versus our society's obsession with thinness and hairlessness in women, which is really a sign of prepubescence, not fertility. All right, so in addition to civilization's oppression of women, it really puts, you know, man at the top of everything, like that pyramid we showed before, just like the one on the left, whereas the one on the right is really how, you know, sustainable indigenous cultures know that the world is. It's a web of life. Everything's interconnected and depends on each other. It's not really a hierarchy. Okay. So I have a quote from Alanis Obomsawin of the Abenaki tribe. He's just talking about Canada because that's, you know, the country that's, I guess, you know, colonized where his people live, but you could substitute, you know, anyone in there, like the U.S. So Canada, the most affluent of countries, operates on a depletion economy which leaves destruction in its wake. Your people are driven by a terrible sense of deficiency. When the last tree is cut, the last fish is caught, and the last river is polluted, when to breathe the air is sickening, you will realize too late that wealth is not in bank accounts and that you can't eat money. So obviously, you know, our culture really needs to learn this lesson before we have to learn it the hard way. Humans exploiting the natural world primarily through agricultural activities has really led to this, you know, just ridiculous exponential increase in human population. There are different estimates of the, you know, carrying capacity for humans on the Earth, but, you know, no matter where that line is, we're definitely over it, and we're definitely diminishing that carrying capacity every day by further degrading the land. Meanwhile, hunter-gatherers lived in small communities, and that's where that line is, you know, before agriculture. It's pretty flat. There wasn't, you know, this crazy, unsustainable human population growth. And then real quick, real quick, the last characteristic that I want to talk about is the health of hunter-gatherer societies. There's a really good source on this called the Weston A. Price Foundation. I really recommend you looking that up if you want more information on this. It's named after the doctor who did research on this subject. He noticed that almost all of his adult patients had just terrible tooth decay and all these other problems like arthritis and diabetes and osteoporosis. And it was getting worse in like the next generation. His child patients had, you know, the same awful tooth decay, asthma, allergies, poor vision, chronic fatigue, all that kind of awful things. He became interested in studying isolated parts of the world that hadn't been touched by civilization to see, you know, what's the difference, what's their health like, why. He found that they basically had, you know, no dental problems at all, no tooth decay, no crowding, beautiful, you know, straight white teeth like you see on the left, and they had virtually no disease either. And you can compare this to data from the U.S. This is from the CDC. As of 2012, about half of all adults in the U.S. had one or more chronic health conditions, and almost one in four adults had two or more chronic health conditions. Seven of the top 10 causes of death in 2010 were chronic diseases, and two of these, heart disease and cancer, caused almost half of all deaths in the U.S. in that year. So Price attributed this discrepancy in health to the difference in diet, the agriculture versus hunter-gatherer diet. Healthy hunter-gatherer societies ate meat with its fat, organ meats, fish, insects, whole grains, vegetables, fruit. They didn't eat white sugar, refined carbohydrates, and vegetable oils like we do in an agricultural society. I also just think it's interesting. He noted that there were no vegetarian cultures that had, you know, this level of impressive health. So hopefully you've learned something that you didn't already know, and now we're going to go into some misconceptions that you still might have about indigenous cultures.
All right, so that title on the last slide was a little too early. So now we're getting to the myths. So the main ones we're going to look at is that in these hunter-gatherer societies, life is hard and death is easy. That, you know, those societies are just primitive, you know, we shouldn't live like them. They don't have any free time. And, you know, those hunter-gatherers, they have no societal structures. And they're always warring, and they're even evolutionary backwards. Right? Yeah. So, many people think that hunter-gatherers live a very difficult life, always worried about being starved, or starving, or being killed. In fact, hunter-gatherers are less prone to resource unpredictability, famines, and food shortages than agriculturalists, even though agriculturalists spend most of their time growing and preparing food. In 2014, 14% of U.S. households were food insecure, meaning they didn't have adequate food supply. This doesn't even take into account the quality of the food that they have, only quantity. So yeah, and just like Charlie said before, the food was that we're eating now is terribly unhealthy for us, so we're not even getting what we should be eating, and when we do, it's not even enough. So here's some statistics about the lifespan. Of course, infant and child mortality is higher for hunter-gatherers than it is in contemporary United States. In a study on hunter-gatherer societies that included the Hmong, of which I spoke earlier, it was found that 58% of children born survived to age 15, and 61% of those who reached 15 survived to age 45. But once age 45 is reached, expected lifespan is another 15 to 24 years, which puts their total lifespan at 60 to 69 years. Compare that to our average life expectancy currently of 71 years. And, So However, this discrepancy in lifespan isn't something that's, you know, hard set in stone. As Yvette Cooper, a former public health minister for the United Kingdom, said in 2000, there is now a risk that the increase in life expectancy that we have seen in recent years could be lost for the next generation. And as Richard H. Carmona, the then Surgeon General of the United States in 2004, says, because of the increasing rates of obesity, unhealthy eating habits, and physical inactivity, we may see the first generation that will be less healthy and have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. So this, you know, idea that civilization brings, you know, longer life if you live under it, it's really just a drawdown of life. You know, we're pulling from future generations as well as the life around us that exists currently through pollution and overconsumption. Here's another common myth. The hunter-gatherers are primitive or even ape-like. But, you know, really my first response to that is, what's so wrong with being ape-like? And you can see here, they're pretty much just us, except a little hairier. You know, our psychology isn't very different, except that we have a much more developed frontal lobe. You know, I don't see apes clear-cutting forests, damming rivers, and destroying fish populations, removing mountaintops for mining, and irreversibly altering the planet's climate so that it might end up being completely devoid of life. You know, maybe except for a couple bacteria. But anyway, you know, what's your measure of being primitive? That affects how we could debunk this myth. And if it's compassion towards humans or even just, you know, others in your species, I think hunter-gatherers have a speed on that one. For example, hunter-gatherers show more warmth and affection towards their children, evident in, you know, cultures that still exist today through the way they treat children, the way they, you know, teach them through positive reinforcement instead of negative reinforcement, which is rampant in this country as well as others that are similar to it. And you can also see this generally in the happiness of people in the societies that you study, as well as the health of children and the focus of the community for the health of children. And if your measure of primitivism is art, I'd like to quote Pablo Picasso after he saw some of these paintings in the Upper Paleolithic, or from the Upper Paleolithic Age in the La Salle Cave in France. We have invented nothing. You know, we've been doing art since we've been we, essentially. Art is part of human culture, not civilization. And I think that's pretty important to point out. So now Charlie's going to take the rest of the myths.
All right, so related to that last point, there's this myth that hunter-gatherers, you know, don't have any free time. They're just worried about, like, basic, you know, survival, and they don't have time to do anything else. So first of all, I mean, how could they have created, you know, those beautiful paintings if they didn't have free time? And I'd also like to quote this report. Reports on hunter-gatherers of today, specifically on those in marginal environments, suggest a mean of 3 to 5 hours per adult worker daily in food production. Instead of continuous travail, the food quest is intermittent, leisure abundant, and there's a greater amount of sleep in the daytime per person yearly for hunter-gatherer societies than in any other society. It's almost inconceivable for a person to die of hunger or even to fail to satisfy their hunger for more than a day or two. So obviously that's not true, and I just wish that I only had to work, you know, 3 to 5 hours a day. I was at work for 8 hours today, so. Another myth is that, you know, hunter-gatherers are these, like, savages with no kind of societal structures or, you know, social mores. As discussed before, the structure of sustainable hunter-gatherer cultures were and are largely egalitarian, especially, you know, compared to our culture. For example, the Chumash protect their communities, which includes their environment. If someone hunted out of season, there was strict punishment. You know, there's definitely societal structures. It's not just, you know, every man for himself kind of thing. And going along with this, you know, some people think that our government, that structure, the police and the military keep us safe, while hunter-gatherers, you know, are warlike and they're always, like, fighting and killing each other. First of all, I'd like to point out that the police and courts do an abysmal job of protecting women from rapists, like I talked about before. Also, 1,207 people were killed in the U.S. last year by police. So, who are they protecting? Mainly the rich and powerful, you know, not people like us. And there's evidence that the earlier Stone Age, there's no evidence that the earlier Stone Age was full of war as many people think it was. To quote Andrea Smith from her book Conquest, 70% of tribes did not practice war at all. For those that did engage in war, the intent was generally not to annihilate the enemy, but to accrue honor through bravery. One accrued more honor by getting close enough to an enemy to touch him and leaving him alive than by killing him. Tom Holm writes, traditional Indian warfare are much more common with Euro-American contact sports like football, boxing, hockey than with wars fought in the European manner. This, of course, is not to say that nobody was ever killed. They were, just as they are in modern contact sports. But the point of the exercise was not, as a rule, purposely lethal. All right. So we also know of several conditions that make war more likely, like the geographic concentration of resources, stationary rather than nomadic life, high population densities, storage of food, domestication of livestock, long-distance trade, and political and social hierarchies. All of those characteristics sound like civilization, not hunter-gatherer societies. And, I mean, just think about it. When was the last time the U.S. wasn't at war? It seems like it's constant. All right, so the final myth that I want to talk about is the myth of progress. The title of this talk is Thinking Critically About Progress, so let's do that. The dominant culture believes that our current way of life is the result of some kind of evolutionary progress, and that the entire planet's history has basically culminated in producing us, Homo sapiens sapiens. The devaluing of the natural world, women, and indigenous people goes hand in hand with this way of thinking. Civilization is a death cult. It must constantly grow and conquer more land, leaving destruction and suffering in its wake. It ignores the reality that women are life givers when it says that God created us and God is male. It ignores the reality that the needs of the natural world are primary and that we need a healthy planet to survive when it says that the economy and growth are the most important. It ignores the reality that indigenous cultures know how to live healthily and sustainably when it commits genocide against them and steals their land. So the truth really is that civilization is the backwards, difficult, unstable, and violent way of life, and the real savages are the civilized industrial capitalists. Ridding the planet of civilization would benefit basically all life, birds, fish, rivers, oceans, prairies, the Arctic, and even humans in the long run. That's real progress. The only question is, how do we get there?
Great. So here's some ideas. I'm actually going to jump to this one and come back to that.
Sure.
I want to just say, you know, So what are some movements and what are some things happening that it's sort of towards maybe reversing civilization, going back to a more wild way, more, you know, or preserving the indigenous people's ways that still exist? And one thing is obviously indigenous resistance itself. The very fact that indigenous people on this land have survived genocide, that is resistance. There's the Unist'ot'en camp in Canada who has built lodging on their traditional lands that blocks a path of a pipeline, and they've been kind of playing this game with this pipeline and preventing them from building it. There are tribes in the Amazon that, you know, do direct action to stop the logging trucks. There's obviously been the American Indian movement in this country. There's a lot of resistance coming from them, and we need to support that, and specifically support that in a way that makes sense to them, which is something that we don't always do. Then I'm going to take it back to... So these represent a few kind of movements that I would consider more of coming from the settler perspective. Permaculture. Permaculture, everybody's probably kind of heard about that one. So that was... You know, the first principle to that is first care for the earth. And the whole idea is creating a permanent culture. And I think it was maybe even permanent agriculture, which is maybe an oxymoron. But the idea is to understand how the natural systems work. It was actually created based on these people who were studying indigenous Australians and New Zealands or something like that, some islands in that area. So it's all based on indigenous life ways. This one here represents rewilding. Rewilding is a movement that's kind of gaining popularity. Okay, thanks. And So anyway, that's about kind of, you know, just on an individual level and also on a bigger level, like how do we start to reverse these things? How can we start to learn how to, what it means to reconnect, to eat wild foods, this and that. This is Transition Towns. It's kind of like another thing that's kind of looking at how do we bring community power, et cetera, to, and kind of transition away from fossil fuels. All these things can be very problematic. I believe, you know, there's this term decolonization, and that's really what we all need to be thinking about on multiple levels. All of these things, you can participate in these kind of movements while still having your settler privileges, while still benefiting from the ongoing colonization of this land. And so we need to be, it's a complicated process, but while we're doing things like this which can have value, we need to be recognizing that we're still living on stolen land. We need to be recognizing the leadership of First Nations. We need to be really actively fighting against colonization, always through all these movements. So I think I have to be on my final slide here. So here's a cool definition of decolonization: is the process that repatriates indigenous land and reawakens an indigenous life way for both those resisting colonization and the colonizer. So it's, you know, it's a tricky process, and but this is really, I think, what we need to be thinking about in all of our movements. And for some of us coming from European ancestry, I mean, it's a very difficult process to come to terms with what our people did and what our this system that our people has created continues to do. And also feel the loss that we have inside of us from our traditional ways and from our traditional lands. And how can we reconnect to some extent to those lands and also honor the land that we are now occupying and figure out how we can reverse this process, which is probably going to involve a lot of things, including, you know, full-on resistance to the United States Empire. And I think I just got a two-minute warning about 2 minutes ago, mm-hmm. So maybe we'll close it there. Oh, yeah, there's some resources here.
Our presentation can be emailed out. I know some people are writing stuff down. Even if you didn't write something down that you wanted to, or if you didn't write anything down and you know, want to retain some of this information better, we have a list here. You can write down your name, or if you don't want to write down your name, that's fine. Just write your email. And there's also a little box if you want some additional information, as well as this PowerPoint.
And
yeah.
And so these are the resources. We can come back to that.
These are our emails if you want to, you know, take that down and ask us any questions later, because it seems like we don't have much time right now. But yeah. Until we get kicked out, we can take any questions. I love it.
All right. Well, thank you. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I mean, if we're still sitting around.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate this analysis, because I think, particularly with the environmental movement, everyone points a finger to capitalism, which is a great start, but I don't think it goes far enough. So thanks for remembering.
I also wanted to add, thank you for bringing up like this critique of progress. That's a good project we should all be engaged in, and bringing up some of the indigenous wisdom that is really relevant today. But at the same time, I kind of want to play devil's advocate a little bit and say, you know, there's also, I argue there's also a worthwhile project of being critical of kind of regressing as well. Like, we have to deal with the problems we have today, and this maybe this is obvious to everybody, but sometimes we romanticize the way that civilizations, societies, cultures existed in the past. Mm-hmm. But we have to deal with the populations we have now. So, for example, some folks have a very libertarian streak and want to, just live in the land somewhere and, be self-sufficient and do that kind of thing. But more collective future, one can argue, and many people argue, is more in an urban environment. And there's many critiques of how cities have been, come into being, for example, but there's just not enough space for everybody to have thousands of acres and their little log cabin. So there are a lot of ways we have to kind of learn from the past, but figure out how does that gel with what's going on.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was just told that we have to be out of here.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.